Okay, this is continuing with Groot Reber on 25th November, October 75.
It's working now.
Right, I was asking you if you ever had any interest in astronomy.
Well, yes. I was always, I think, from a child, interested in astronomy. And I remember a number of times I talked to my parents, but they weren't interested in these things. And they weren't any more interested in science or the world that surrounds them than the people are today.
Yeah.
Most people are pretty uninterested in the natural world that surrounds them. And I was given a camera at a rather early age, maybe 12 or so. Mm-hmm. And I just recently, within the past few weeks, when I was digging through my archives, stumbled over some old photographs I had taken at that day.
Hmm.
I don't know exactly when they were, but they must have been in the 1920s, where I apparently set the camera on a fence post with the shutter open. And took pictures of the stars and got streaks.
Yeah, the star trail.
Some
amazing.
There that I've made notations on. I think there was a configuration of, I think, four planets out in the west, and I took pictures of these and
uh-huh.
showed. I remember now, because these were developed, and of course I expected to see the streaks of the bright planets, but I was dumbfounded to find streaks on there of stars which I couldn't even see.
Right.
And this was, I'm sure, before 1930.
This is as a high school probably, or junior high school maybe.
Because we moved about 32, not far, just 50 yards or so. And the pictures taken are from a place which must have been when I lived in the old home. So it would have been before 1930. You see, I was fairly young at the time.
And did you study any astronomy at the Institute?
No. See, astronomy was not the kind of thing you'd get in engineering school.
Right. I thought there might have been an odd course or something. But
no, I read some astronomical books, you know, of my own volition out of the local library. Incidentally, in the small town of Wheaton, I don't know what the population was of that day, maybe 3,500, had been very fortunate in having some wealthy people live there who were public-spirited, and one of them had given a very fine library to the community.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's still there. And I got books from that, you know, but that was all.
Okay, so you did have a peripheral interest in astronomy anyway. Well, I think you're sort of curious about everything that's going on around you.
Oh, and, yeah,
I gather.
That's true.
Astronomy was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you first become aware of Jansky's work?
Well, I think very soon, the time those papers were published, because you see, I was a radio amateur, naturally interested in radio, and I didn't have much of any money at that time, nobody did. And so I didn't go out buying magazines. But there at the school I was going to, had these engineering magazines, and I used to read them regularly and religiously.
I see.
Because they had a lot of interesting articles about equipment.
Sure.
And this article by Jansky today probably wouldn't have been published in an engineering magazine. It would have been published in some physics magazine or astronomy.
Geophysics or something. Yeah.
Hard to say.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it appeared in these engineering magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And I was immediately greatly struck by it.
Even the first article?
Oh, yeah.
The one that
But you see, I was still in school.
Right.
And I didn't have any money or anything. And times were very different. The young people today have no comprehension of how things were then. But everybody today got lots of money in their pocket.
Yeah.
But nobody had any money in their pocket in that day. And it wasn't until I had gotten out of school and was able to make my own way that I had enough money to do anything with.
Right. Are you implying that if you'd had some money at that time that you might have wanted to follow up Jansky's work right then, in 1910?
Perhaps, although that's
it's hard to say,
speculation.
Yeah, right.
But in retrospect, it's pretty easy to see. See, I got interested in this actively doing something about 1936. Well, I got out of school in 33, and it was at least a year or more before I got a job worth anything. So it was about 1935 by the time I got a job where I could support myself and have anything left over.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably about the following year that I felt fluent enough to have any wherewithal to do anything.
Right. And by this time, Jansky had published two additional papers, of course.
That's right.
Which probably whetted your appetite even further.
Could well be. And I remember writing to Jansky, I think I can still produce a letter, asking him. See, by this time I was working in the radio industry in Chicago. I wrote to him, asking him if they were going to do anything more on this. And if they were, I would like to be considered as an applicant for such jobs as might be open.
Right.
And he wrote back and said they weren't going to do anything more, unfortunately, and that was that.
Now, I have some questions here I wanted to ask you about Jansky. You may not know them, but here is one of them, obviously. What do you know about why Bell Labs did not follow it up? Did Jansky really want to and his bosses wouldn't let him? Or do you know anything about all this?
I wasn't there. And there seems to be a difference of opinion. This man from New Hope, Pennsylvania, wrote a book that he purported to go around and interview Jansky's relatives and read Jansky's letters.
Oh, you mean Pfeiffer?
I guess so.
John Pfeiffer?
Yeah, I think that's the guy.
In the 50s, he wrote that book, yeah.
Anyhow, he attempts to develop a case that Jansky was suppressed. I have no information on that whatsoever. Then, some years later, not too many years later, Frisch writes himself some letters in Nature, I guess it is, or Science, defending himself, saying that he wasn't the guy that suppressed Jansky.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I have no information whatsoever on any of that.
You don't. I thought you might have known Jansky well. And
oh, no. I met him two or three times, but that was all.
I see. Okay, well, I've got to do some more digging at Bell Labs to try to get this story straight then.
I don't think you can. I'd say this. See, your memory gets fuzzy. And see, preparatory for this Jansky lecture, I've been digging through my archives down there. Now, who are the two from Carnegie? Brooke, Burke, and
Franklin.
That's right. They discovered radiation from Jupiter by accident in 1955, at a frequency of 22 megacycles.
Right.
At that time, I was in Tasmania making my first exploratory experiments, and I looked through my old Hawaii records, and I was able to find some in 1952, 1953.
Mm-hmm.
I could attribute to Jupiter at about 20 megacycles.
In
I didn't recognize it for such.
Shane did the same thing, of course.
Yeah, even earlier, about 1950-51. So, I thought to myself, my guy, I'll bet you Jansky's got a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he had over a year of continuous recordings. So I wrote to the Bell Labs, 453 West Street, saying just what I've told you, that I would like to find out about the situation on Jansky's recordings, that I would be in the States the next year, and I would like an opportunity to look these things over.
Mm-hmm.
I got a letter back rather promptly from somebody saying that they had Jansky's notebook and folded into pages the notebook with one of his recordings, but all the others had mysteriously disappeared.
Hmm. And as far as you know, they're still not...
So, I didn't follow it up. But then I found, see now, your memory gets poor. That's the reason written pieces of paper are better than this memory stuff. That's the reason I'm a bit dubious about you taking all these recordings down.
Well, no, I take that into account. I mean, before you really believe anything, you have to have some more documentation for it. But there are all sorts of useful leads that you can get.
Anyhow, just within the past few weeks, in digging through my archives, I found a piece of paper in my handwriting. And it's dated the 18th of February, 1956.
Mm-hmm.
It says, according to Southworth, Jansky's recordings were kept in an old farmhouse, which was demolished in 1949. Then H.T. Friss in charge. That's all it says.
Huh.
Now, I don't remember this. Apparently it was a telephone conversation.
Nice.
And I have no record that I followed up with Friss or anybody else. But that little piece of paper is there.
But that may be the... That may have been the fate of Jansky's recordings, though, huh?
So, Anyhow, that was 1956. Now, another thing happened, entirely unconnected and unexpected. But in 1960 or 61, I was at Greenbank, West Virginia, supervising the reconstruction of my dish.
Mm-hmm.
And they were embarking on some microwave experiments because about that time the 85-foot dish was being completed, although it was quite a few years before the 140-foot dish got finished. And they had some pretty competent technicians there and a couple of good engineers.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, they invited down from Bell Labs a man named A.C. Beck, who was a contemporary of Jansky's, to look at what their microwave boys were doing, because Beck apparently was an expert on this microwave relay stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to get some independent opinion on the competence of what was going on at Greenbank. Mm-hmm. So Beck was there on that mission. And he was there for two or three days. And so I had an opportunity to sit down a number of times and talk to Beck. Beck was a contemporary of Jansky's. He didn't participate in what Jansky was doing, but he was there at the time doing other things and very aware of what Jansky was doing. And if you recall the famous photograph of Jansky in knickers,
right,
and his machine, it shows that the antennas are under pipes and that the machine is supported on wheels that have pneumatic tires.
Right.
Now, Beck says that after Jansky's experiments were finished, Beck used that machine, that the pipes were taken off, and it was used for setting up antenna measuring experiments. That is, the transmitter was put off at some distance, and the antenna under test was put on this machine and turned around, and they got patterns.
Right.
And he is very positive that that machine had hard rubber tires. Absolutely. So this merely tells you that somewhere in the interim the service department got tires, inflating the tires and put on hard rubber.
Because originally they were old Model A tires.
That's right. Right. Model T's, I think.
Model T, yeah.
Yeah, see. So.
Well, let me ask a more general question. Do you know now of any archives to do with Jansky's work?
That's what I'm getting to. So, Beck had a lot of records too. The electronic gear was different, but apparently the same leads and Northrop recorded using the same charts. And according to him, there was what he called a red barn. And his records were stored in the red barn.
Mm-hmm.
And these records of his, those Beck's, were in cartons placed alongside cartons that contained Jansky's records. And he recalled very positively that they were both there. Now the year I don't know, but
this was back in the early 60s, he recalled.
Oh, earlier than that, before 1949.
Well, but he told you this around 1960. Right, but he recalls that they were there around 1949.
Yes, yeah. Maybe in the middle 40s. If you, in the Bell Labs journals, there are a number of papers on antennas and propagation where Beck had his name attached. I think Beck's still alive.
Right, I was just checking that, as a matter of fact. Do you know if Fries is still alive?
I think so. He was a few years ago.
I haven't been able to find him anywhere. But Beck, Penzias told me about Beck. Let me see if I can find that. Here we go. Yeah, now living in Florida. But I haven't been able to look him up, or I guess I haven't really tried. I should definitely try to talk with him, shouldn't I?
Well, anyhow, Beck's records and Jansky's records are stored in what Beck calls the Red Barn, which probably is the same thing that Southworth called the old house.
Right.
And Beck then is apparently assigned to other work, and he's no longer at Holmdel. And he then comes back. According to Beck, he came back some dozen years later. And this place where Jansky's machine was and the Red Barn and the old house now was a huge structure, a tremendous laboratory.
Hmm.
Everything had been gone.
I see.
So Beck tries to find out what happened to his recordings. And of course, there isn't anybody there who knows anything about it, because right. everybody there now is new. How do you find anybody that was there when he was there some dozen years prior?
Right.
And he gets apparently sort of annoyed, and so he decides, he just gets, you know, run around.
Right.
And so he hunts up a yardsman or a groundsman, you know, caretaker. And he questions him. And lo and behold, now the mystery is solved. The orders come from New York at sometime about 1949, that they've got to clear this place, preparatory to build a new laboratory. And so everything is cleared off, and this structure, the old barn, is demolished, and everything in it is done for. And they're told to make a clean sweep and clean everything up. So this groundsman cleans everything up. And this particular bloke, who he told me the name and I've forgotten, is the fellow that burnt all the records. So they're definitely going out in smoke. Now,
what a shame.
The mystery of what happened to Jansen Starks is now solved, but this, of course, really brings forward another mystery as to how this kind of a thing happens.
Right.
Now,
you think that
I'm telling you what Beck told me, and if you want, you can see Beck and confirm it.
Right.
Now, if Chris hears this, he's not going to like it, because I think he was the guy in charge, but I have nothing to do with it.
Right. Well, these things happen. They're a shame. It does, but they do happen. Because
I think I brought this up with Beck on the basis of what about Jansky's records in Jupiter.
Right.
And then he told me what I just told you.
Yeah, I calculated that Jansky would have easily been able to see solar bursts or Jupiter bursts.
Sure.
But of course it was solar minimum, so
yeah.
He was hurting there. But that helped him actually, because he didn't have all this interference.
Sure.
But let me ask you another thing. Do you know how Jansky took your work? I mean, was he sort of glad to see finally someone following it up?
Oh, I think so. Sure. A couple times I met him, he complimented me on what I'd been able to do and sort of wished that he'd been able to do it, but that was all.
Yeah. Did you sort of see yourself as sort of following in the footsteps of Jansky?
Yeah.
It seems that way from the way you
were. Oh, definitely. That is, if he had made the discovery, certainly I would have never undertaken anything like that. It'd been foolish.
Right.
Because you have to remember, at that day, I didn't know anything about Lodge or Edison or Norton or anything. Those all came to light much later.
Right, right. I think when the bibliographies were put together after the war. Yeah. Well, while we're talking about Jansky, let me ask you, in 1948 or 9, in Sky and Telescope, you published Jansky's measurements in the form of a contour map on the sky. Now, where did you get the data to do that? Was it only what he published?
If you look through Jansky's papers,
right.
He gives one 24-hour period of very clear data.
Yeah, I know that figure. And that's where you
And I scaled that stuff off and converted to galactic coordinates, and that's it.
I see.
That's where it came from. And that same date, if you recall, look on that date, and it's the same date that he gave.
Right, that's what I figured, but I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
And also, as far as Jansky's antenna pattern, did you make a detailed calculation of exactly what it was, or just sort of an estimate?
In the correspondence I had with Jansky, he gave me the parameters, that is, the polar coordinate diagram, both vertical and horizontal.
Right, he only published the horizontal one. He never published the vertical one, that's what I...
Well, he gave me both.
I see.
Including the ground reflection coefficient.
Right.
And so I computed them both. I still have those. Matter of fact, I looked at them within the past few weeks, those diagrams and all that stuff that Jansky gave me, and the formulas and everything.
Hmm.
And the pattern is the same 30 degrees wide in azimuth, but in the vertical,
you quoted
it's about 60 degrees up here and about 20 degrees here.
Yeah, you quoted 37, I think, at one point.
Something like that, see?
It's asymmetric too, isn't it? In the vertical direction.
Oh yes, because it doesn't come down to the ground.
Right,
can't.
Right.
See? 37 degrees half power beam width, I guess, but that's not from the ground. There's about 15 degrees from there to the ground.
I've been trying to redo all this, but it seems like you've got the information I need, like the ground reflectivity and all that. Okay. Another question about Jansky's paper I've never been able to figure out is he quotes at the end of his first paper that the maximum signal that he got for this strange hiss was 0.39 microvolts per meter. And that maximum seems to be far more than any of his traces or than anything else he talks about. He just adds this sentence on at the end. I can't make it tie in anywhere. Do you remember anything of this as to what that means? All the other values that he quotes seem to be much lower than that.
I wouldn't know.
Okay. Well, maybe I can show you the paper and it might, after we're finished, it might ring a bell. I'll just make a note here. Let's see if I have anything else on Jansky. Okay. I wanted to ask you, do you have a bibliography of all of your papers?
No.
I've put one together as far as I can do, but I was wondering if you might have one.
That list of stuff that's at the bottom of the 1958 paper is pretty complete. I don't think much has been left out.
Okay, okay. Okay, here's another question about the early days, which will get us into this article, in Early Radio Astronomy, Wheaton, Illinois, and I have several questions along the way through it, but I have contacted a fellow named Lutz that you apparently wrote to. He was in Indiana, I think. S.G. Lutz.
How do you spell that?
L-U-T-Z, or Lutz, maybe.
I don't remember. Go on. What did I say?
Okay. Now, he was an expert on microwave tubes at Purdue, I'm sorry.
Oh.
And I was told that he was an early radio expert, but I didn't realize that when I called him up, he would actually have had some contact with you. Apparently, he received a letter from you around 1937 requesting help in building a closed space diode so you could do this high frequency work.
Mm-hmm.
And he indeed was doing research in this sort of thing. He had the technology, but according to him himself, he was uncooperative because you would not give the purpose of your project.
Mm.
And he says he really regrets now that he missed this chance to help, because he says that he's a little bit on the wild side himself, that he always likes to go for these far-out projects, and that all that he can deduce is that you wouldn't tell him, because then you would be branded a nut, because it would be sort of like interstellar communication or something if you were trying
to... I don't remember anything about that.
You don't remember this at all? Do you remember similar other attempts of trying to get aid from people and sort of getting rebuffed? Because it was too wild an idea?
Well, obviously, I did write to this gent if he's got my letter. And the reply I got, obviously, was negative, and so I've forgotten it.
Right.
I probably wrote to other people. And as you sit here, an article in some German magazine where they built a diode that had a glass bellows that could be expanded and contracted slightly to change the spacing between the anode and the cathode. And I wrote to this German concern, Telefunken, whoever it was, requesting would they build one for me? And they wrote back in German, which I had translated, that they would. But they wanted $200, which was a tremendous price. You could buy a real good used car for $200 in that day. And so that was the end of that.
Yeah.
Now beyond that, I don't remember anything.
Well, I suppose then that your main source of equipment and so forth was what you could get from the company you were working at the time.
That's right.
You could borrow stuff temporarily. Yeah. And
I was in a preferred position. That is, I was in a good location, not living in a Chicago flat or something like that. That is, I had this home out in the suburbs, which wasn't as good as a country home, but it was open and spacious, and there was some room there to do something, and I was not stamped upon by relatives.
Right.
And I worked in the city in the engineering department of radio manufacturers and had access to what of that day was the best electronic equipment available. Some of it was useful, some of it wasn't. The main difficulty was that the frequencies I was interested in were not the kind of frequencies that the electronic test equipment. But to the extent I could use it, yes.
Sure.
And I don't know how things are today, but they were pretty liberal. That is, I could come in there on Saturdays, or I had a key, and I could come and work in the shop and
sure.
build things, or stay at night, and that kind of stuff, you know.
And, by the way, was this home where the antenna was this your old family home? I mean, did you just continue to live there?
No, really. The old family home was, I think it says in there, 225 West Wesley Street.
Right, right.
Well, about 50 yards away, on the next street, this was an open square, was another house which had been built by my parents, apparently to live in when they were married. But they never did, because they came to live with her folks who gathered, were getting on in years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was brought up in the old home, while the one that they had built for their use apparently was rented. And we only moved over there quite many years later, about 1932 or 33.
I see. But you did live there during this whole time.
On this square, yes.
Yeah, and essentially you were living on it. What I'm trying to get at, you were living right where the antenna was.
Yes.
And you say now all this property now belongs to the Illinois Bell Telephone Company.
That's right, we sold it all to the telephone company.
But the houses are not there anymore, I take it.
Oh, the houses were moved.
Yeah. Okay, well I think got things marked here, so if I'll just go through this. Probably be the
houses are still there, at least last time I saw them a dozen years ago. I mean, they've been moved to another location. In other words, they're still in existence.
You mentioned here that when you were doing your ham observing or operating, that on quiet nights it was always possible to make the receiver quieter by taking off the antenna. And do you have any more ideas as to whether that really was cosmic noise or not?
The reason I took off the antennas was simply when you put the transmitter in there, I had an antenna disconnect switch.
I see.
That's all.
So it may or may not have been. Okay, I found out that. Okay, now you came upon the idea to build a large parabolic reflector. And I'd like to ask you, how did you come to that idea? I think that this dish must have been the largest of its kind in the world.
Probably was at that day.
And I presume that radio engineers had built some small ones. But how in the world did you... Was it all completely your own design work on mm-hmm. how much the thing would deflect and how accurate it had to be and what the best F over D ratio and all of this sort of thing was?
Well, it wasn't that detailed. But the F over D ratio, I think I explained in there, was determined by the pattern that came out of the end of an open waveguide. And so I decided that it had to have whatever it was, 6/10 F over D ratio.
So it was determined by the feed then?
That's right, see, by the feed. And as far as the rest of the structure was concerned, it was expediency. That is, the longest 4x2 I could get in the local lumber yard were 20 feet long. And so without having to splice, how big a dish could I build, which the longest member was 20 feet. And that turned out to be something that would hold about a 32-foot dish.
Amazing.
That's all.
And you talk about the frequency that you observed was determined by the size of the drum that you got
for the
first high-frequency stuff.
Sure. All expedient. See, there was nothing else to go on. That is,
yeah.
There was no reason why any frequency should be better or worse than any other frequency.
Yeah. But the amazing thing to me, though, is that your 30-foot antenna looks very similar to this 30-foot antenna here that we've been talking about that now is at Battelle.
Yeah, except that's got a shorter F over D ratio.
Yeah, but not terribly different.
No, not different. Great.
But it seems like you happened upon it bit by chance in what now is known to be the right design, or the optimum design.
Well, I don't know, but supposing you had an open selection of choices, you could have something which was very deep.
Mm-hmm.
It was obvious from the pattern that came out of the end of a waveguide that a very deep one wouldn't be suitably illuminated.
Mm-hmm.
So that was out. On the other hand, supposing we had something very shallow. This man had very long focal length.
Yeah,
and unless
this
very long focal length had some particular merit, it's going to be a difficult thing to build.
Mm-hmm. So I see. So you,
between these two, you came up with sort of a compromise.
Right.
And that's what
right.
it was. That's
okay,
all.
Okay, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Most of these things people try to read too much into. That is, there wasn't a lot of intelligent, deep, theoretical thought on these things. You had all these various options and you sort of shuffled them around and came up with one that looked pretty good.
Well, I think the point is that you had a very good feel for what...
Well, maybe so. Maybe so.
The average person would have come up with a very different set of options that wouldn't work.
Shuffled them around, maybe not come up as
right.
satisfactorily.
Right. Now, you say here, I conceived the idea of using a single dipole inside a short length of waveguide at the focus of the mirror. Like I say, presumably there had been smaller antennas before that had been illuminated with a feed and so forth. So that was not an original idea with you. You just scaled it up, really, to a larger size, is that correct, than it had been before? What were the unique problems that you had to face, I guess is what I want to ask.
I don't quite know the answer, but it was apparent you had to have some kind of a collector device which would collect from the direction you chose to look at and exclude radiations from all spurious directions.
Mm-hmm.
And spurious directions weren't going to be limited merely by the diffraction pattern, but they were going to be delimited by what's called leakage, coming mm-hmm. in not through the dish, but around the dish.
Spillover, we call it.
Yeah, see? And so the antenna itself, the actual pickup, had to be in some kind of a case or some kind of a box that would shield it from the surroundings. Really all about it.
What about the accuracy of the surface? Was it sort of obvious that that had to be accurate to a tenth of a wavelength or something like that?
A quarter of a wavelength, yeah. Anyhow. And so that was built as accurately as possible. But in the meantime, you see, while this was going on, I was doing those experiments with a magnetron tube.
Mm-hmm.
And it became apparent that the shortest wavelength to which I was going to have any access to was on the order of 8-9 centimeters. A tenth of a wavelength like that would be maybe 1 centimeter, which is, say, 3/8 of an inch. And so if the overall accuracy was within 3/8 or 1/4 of an inch, it would be all that would possibly be needed. And that was fairly easy to achieve,
mm-hmm.
because all these ribs, I got all those cut to plus or minus a 1/16. They were easy to cut out. And then I never did know what the accuracy of the dish was tipped, but when it was pointed straight up, it was that, see, there's a flat plane, reference plane, that the ribs are fastened to.
Mm-hmm.
And that reference plane was set up accurately to about plus or minus a 1/16 or so mm-hmm. by washers.
So that shimmed, you mean?
Shimmed,
yeah.
See? So you had that reference plane leveled
then
up.
Then you referenced your parabola to that plane?
Exactly. So, supposing there was a 1/16 error there, then there might be a 1/16 error in the vertical state
right.
rods. There might be another 1/16 error in the ribs. Perhaps another 1/16 in the bending. So, as a reasonable estimate, it would be plus or minus 1/4 of an inch. That'd be good enough.
Yeah. Well, that would be a maximum deviation. They would normally not combine altogether.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean. Yeah, it'd be a maximum error.
Maybe
the average error
would
probably be a lot less than
yeah.
that. Maybe an eighth. But if you take that 1/8 of an inch and divide it into 32 feet, you have a pretty fair-sized sum. That is, I think that's what they characterize the dishes on now, the ratio of the average error to the diameter.
Right. But now, I haven't asked you perhaps the most fundamental question, and that is, what can you give me any insight into what in the world came over you to embark on such a huge project in your backyard, essentially? I mean,
it looked pretty big, true, but I was already convinced in the beginning that there was no sense of fooling around with something small. As I point
because
out,
because of the resolution.
That's right, see? And the ability to pick things up, pick energy up. Mm-hmm. So it had to be as big as I could possibly handle. That's all. The reason it wasn't 50 feet was that I didn't have the wherewithal, either financially or mechanically, to build anything bigger.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
But still, this was taking up, must have been taking up all of your spare time for many, right. many years. So, I mean, you must have committed yourself to this, essentially.
Yeah, that is, I took a summer off and didn't do anything else.
That was the summer of 37, I think?
1937, yeah.
And that was when you
actually...
About
that time, I changed jobs, I think. I think I shifted from Stuart Warner. I left Stuart Warner and took a summer off, and when I went back to work... See, Chicago is a very large city. It also was, at least at that time, practically the center of the radio industry. And there were a lot of different radio companies. And so, it wasn't going to be difficult to find another job if I couldn't get one back at Stuart Warner.
Right. And so you took a summer off precisely to erect this antenna,
exactly.
Really?
I was much younger than I used to get up early and work from 7 in the morning till 7 at night. I don't do that anymore.
And, well, like you say, it's very good that you wrote this down. You have all the details about people helping you to build it. And here it is. The entire job was completed in 4 months, from June to September 37. And you talk about the local inhabitants were worried that the machine was collecting water and controlling the weather and so forth.
There was all kinds of unintelligent speculation, a lot of different kinds of things. I don't remember what they all were. Those were some of them.
No matter what you said, I suppose that they wouldn't believe you. Or was it behind your back that they were...
Yes. Back? I don't know if I mentioned it in there, but people used to ring the doorbell and introduce themselves, or maybe not even bother to introduce themselves, and say that they were passing through and they would like to know what that thing next door was.
You mentioned that pilots used to go out of their way to fly over this
thing. Oh, yeah. See, probably from the air it was a curiosity, too.
Sure, sure.
They'd circle around it and around it and around it looking at it.
But I suppose that the neighbors more or less just dismissed you as the local eccentric that was building this thing in his backyard. And
oh, yes. I don't know.
Was that being unfair?
They were particularly interested. But, I was just one of the local boys there, you know, and I was a radio amateur, and well, I was, you know,
just
not feeble-minded, but sort of eccentric.
A radio amateur gone amok or something.
That's right, see. I don't recall that I ever had any particular encounters with them, good or bad. That is, they didn't attempt to interfere with me, nor did they attempt to assist me.
Yeah. Except you got people to help you at certain critical stages where you needed labor. These are just friends, I guess.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Another amazing thing to me is just the fact that you had a hole there so you could have had a Gregorian focus if you'd wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Did that idea just come from optical work?
That's all. I don't know why I put that down there, but I thought, all right, if this thing is being built, it better be built so there's not an obstruction in the middle, just in case. I want to put my electronic apparatus at the bottom of this thing and put on a secondary, just in case. See, that wasn't feasible at later frequencies, but at those highest frequencies, around 3,000 megacycles, it would go through a 2-foot hole. And so it wouldn't pop.
Right.
Well, as an engineer, you design things slightly over. That is, so they have a capability somewhat beyond what the demands are going to be, just in case the demands are slightly underestimated.
Right.
It's just conservatism.
Right, right. So that's what you were doing also in this case.
It was never used.
And now the antenna, as you say, first it went to Sterling, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
When you went to NBS.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was there any research done with it there? This is getting ahead of the story a little bit.
Not really. I went to NBS because there wasn't anything else offering, really. I had some misgivings about it at the time, as I couldn't quite understand what the National Bureau of Standards had to do with radio astronomy.
Yeah.
After I'd been there for a while, it became apparent that I was to be part of one of their internal empires, you might say. And the justification for my existence was that I was supposed to make observations of the radio waves from the sun to be used as an index of solar activity. The solar activity would then be used to predict the conditions of the ionosphere, which mm-hmm. then could be used for predicting communication circuit performance.
Right.
Pretty far-fetched.
Yeah.
But in any case, that was the justification for my existence.
And as part of the deal, when you went there, they said that you can bring your telescope along and...
That's right.
And they'll use that.
That's right.
And what did it ever do in Sterling, West Virginia?
Well, I was the Bureau of Standards. It didn't do anything. After I left, it was used by two people who I've since forgotten. But anyhow, must have been 1952 by this time. Anyhow, these fellows had my dish, set up there in Sterling, Virginia, and they did a moon echo experiment with a transmitter at Collins Cedar Rapids. And that's got published somewhere, I think, in the machine, the IRE.
I see.
And they sent some signals at, 500 megacycles, 300 megacycles, something like that, from Collins, and used my dish to pick it up from the moon. And they decided that with this particular set of physical parameters, that the circuit was suitable for hand telegraphy. And they encountered severe fading. Apparently the moon vibrates. And this vibration was enough to cause some multiple scattering points to add and subtract. I don't recall a fading rate, but it was on the order of several fades per minute. And that's, as far as I know, all that ever came out of it was.
And when was it finally transferred to NREO?
Well, I left there when they decided they were going to move everything to Boulder, Colorado. A lot of other people left. And they hired some contractor to tear everything down and lug it out there to Boulder, Colorado. So it was lugged out there.
Oh, it went to Colorado too.
Oh yeah. It was taken apart along with a lot of other stuff and lugged out to Boulder, Colorado. And at that point some of my equipment disappeared under circumstances very similar to what Chansky's charts disappeared. People in one place issuing orders without having any idea what the consequences were going to be, and other people carrying them out without having any idea what they're doing. And in any case, the dish was dismantled and taken out there. Nothing was ever done with it. And all the pieces apparently lay in a big heap for several years. I don't know when they went out there, maybe 1954 or something like that. Well, in the meantime, NSF got started. And then they developed NRAO. And they finally got some land out of Greenbank about 1959. And Dick Emerson or Burton or somebody got the idea that it'd be a good idea if they could get my dish put back together again. And so they found out that the remains were out of Boulder, Colorado. And about that time I had finished some of my work in Tasmania. So I agreed to come back to Greenbank and help them put the thing together. Right. So I did. In the meantime, they'd lugged out everything from Boulder, Colorado back to Greenbank, West Virginia. But it had laid out there too long. As I mentioned, when it was taken apart in 1947, it was just as good as what it was put together. But after the stuff had laid out in the open for 10 years or so, it wasn't. And all we were able to salvage out of it was the metal pieces, which all had to be sandblasted and cleaned up. So all the metal pieces that are at Greenbank are originals. But the wood pieces were hopeless. They were done for.
Right.
But I fortunately had all my drawings. And so I went back to Wheaton and got my drawings. And they bought new wood. And this time we impregnated them with this copper compound, which makes park benches green, you know, to prevent rot or reduce rot. And all the wood pieces were refabricated. And they had succeeded in getting maybe a half of the sheet metal for the dish. And the other half had departed. Nobody knows where. People had helped themselves. And the remaining half that was in existence was in bad order. That is, a lot of it had been heavily creased and dented and rusted, torn. And so there didn't seem to be any point to trying to use that old stuff. And we bought all new skin for the dish. But this time we bought it out of aluminium instead of galvanized iron. But it was all fabricated in the same design.
Right. So now you're saying that, is there any of the metal that's...